Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
I want an official Red Ryder Cup in action 200 yard range ball arrow.
You'll shoot your eye out, kid.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome to the Patrick Madrid Show. This is Ken Hensley sitting in for Patrick. While he is out putting bows on things, tying ribbon around things, packaging up a million gifts for his 20 or 30 or 40, I can't remember. I'll have to ask Patrick again how many grandchildren he has, or maybe he'll mention it to you. But anyway, thanks for calling in to the Patrick Madrid Show. The number here is 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Cyrus, that clip I heard in there about you're going to shoot your eye out, wasn't that from Schindler's List? It's from a movie, I think, right? I'm kidding. I know. I know the movie it's from. I'm kidding. All right. Well, hour number three of the Patrick Madrid Show. Let's go directly to Emily from Sacramento, California. And Emily, you're on the show. Welcome. I feel like bowing down before you and apologizing because you've been waiting a long time. What's up?
I was kind of just wondering, like, what the hands of God would, like, mean to you, or what you think that means, like the phrase, or if it's a powerful phrase, or...
Okay. When we say things like the hand of God, when we speak of that, well, what it says to me, and I think what it's talking about, is God's providence, God's providential control of the universe. You know, even though from our perspective, one thing happens after another in life, we understand that God rules the world and God brings about things. And so we speak of God's providential control of the world, and we use the fancy word is called anthropomorphism. Anthropomorphism, where we describe God, who is an infinite spirit, we describe God using human terms. And so we speak of the hand of God, but we don't mean by that, or when the Bible speaks it, we don't mean by that that God has hands. We mean that God is acting in the world, that he's doing something. And we speak of the hand of God. It'd be a similar way to when we were, you know, we were talking earlier, Emily, about children in large families. And when you have a child, that is, if you're a Christian, you don't say, well, these certain biological facts and genetic facts have occurred, and here's this thing. No, we say God gave us a daughter, or God gave us a son. We speak of God's providence. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's really cool. I wasn't sure how you viewed it, and I think that's a really cool interpretation.
How would you, or how did you think about it before you called, or how do you think about it?
I think a lot of it has to do with, like, the Word of God, where it's like it's a lot can be triggered by our voices, mm-hmm. where we can trigger His hands or something.
Right.
So.
Right.
Right. It's like being able to trigger His hands and help, it's how He can help people too.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is true. And when I think of it, there are many ways in which this anthropomorphic language is used to describe God in the Bible. You know, like God is described as coming on the clouds. That is when He is bringing judgment. You know, like for instance, in the Old Testament, there was a time when God is described as bringing the Babylonian armies against Jerusalem and his people, Israel, because of their sin. And you know, in terms of what we would have seen if we were there standing on the earth, we would have seen the Babylonian armies coming into Jerusalem and destroying the temple and sacking it and taking many precious things away. But the way it's described in the prophets is that God is sending the Babylonians in to do his work, and it'll be described as God coming on the clouds of heaven. So, you know, all of this is using human terms to try to perceive what God is doing. But this phrase, the hand of God, is a is a beautiful one, is one that occurs often and one we think of often. Emily, thanks so much for holding on all this time, and I hope you go away with something from that, okay?
Thank you very much. Hope you have a nice holiday.
You too. Merry Christmas to you. All right. Well, I'm going to take a few emails that have come in, and there are some lines open if anyone else wants to call to comment on the subject that we talked about first today, that is large Catholic families, the blessing of having large families, and the question, how do you respond when you run into people who kind of make fun of the fact that you have a large family, or maybe even say something kind of bold and bluntly to you, like, are these all your kids? Don't you think you ought to be being a little more considerate, or whatever might be said? If you'd like to call in and comment on that, you're welcome. And then in the last hour, I spoke about happiness and about the secret to where happiness is to be found. And the fact that this lesson is, talk about blessings. There's no blessing greater than to learn that the deep happiness that we are all seeking all the time can only be found in God, and that we need to turn back to God and give our lives to God and begin to live in obedience to Him if we ever want to find the happiness we're looking for. But then there are other things you could bring up too. Anything you want to talk about, 888-914-9149. I will attempt to do what Patrick Madrid does so well and tackle whatever question comes. But here's an email that came. Why does Catholic guilt exist? What do you do about it? Especially when you know it's not justified. Thank you. Why does Catholic guilt exist? And in responding to this, I want to tell you a little joke if I can. Okay, this is a joke about the difference between Catholic guilt and Jewish guilt. And this was told to me by a Jewish convert who laughed his head off when he told it to me. So I hope you don't think this is improper in some way. I don't think it is at all. This was his joke. He said, here's the difference between Catholic guilt, which is kind of a standard trope, you know, Catholic guilt. But he said, here's the difference between Catholic guilt and Jewish guilt. And he was making the point that you Catholics don't have anything on us Jews when it comes to guilt. Here's the difference, he said. A Catholic mother will say to her son, Johnny, if you don't eat your Brussels sprouts, I'm going to kill you. That's what a Catholic mother will say. He said, a Jewish mother will say, Johnny, if you don't eat your Brussels sprouts, I'm going to kill myself. Anyway, that's the joke. I hope some of you out there are laughing. I can't hear any laughs, but then again, I can't hear anything. Well, the idea of Catholic guilt, as I said, it's sort of a common trope. It's a common stereotype, the idea. And sometimes, yes, we feel guilty when we shouldn't. And there are people, there are Catholics, all of us maybe, to one degree or another, struggle with what is called scrupulosity. That is, we become so scrupulous in our attention to what is happening within us in our souls that we begin at times to feel guilty about things that aren't even bad. Or we begin to feel a deep sense of guilt for something that may be nothing more than a little personality foible or flaw. And it's not a moral issue. It's not something that you actually should feel guilty about. And the answer to that, you know, I'm no genius when it comes to a spiritual direction or psychology even, but I would say that if you struggle with scrupulosity, if you believe you do, and if others maybe who know you have told you that you do, that it would be good to seek some spiritual direction. If you have a priest that you trust, to go to that priest, to talk to someone about it, to talk to a priest about it, and ask for some spiritual direction. There's no magic solution if you're the kind of person that just tends to feel bad all the time about everything you do. You know, there are people like that, that just apologize all day long. It's always, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. And you feel at times like saying, stop saying you're sorry, you didn't do anything. Well, there's no magic solution to it. I would say it's part of the struggle for holiness that really is going to continue in all of our lives, every day of our lives, every hour up until the time that we pass from this world. We're going to be struggling always to root out the idols that are in our lives, to stop patterns of sin that we've fallen into and that we continue to fall into. I think about that passage in the Proverbs that says that the righteous man falls seven times a day, even the righteous man falls seven times a day. But the secret is to begin again. The secret always is to stand up and begin again. And there's nothing wrong with feeling guilt when we have reason to. It's what we call conscience. Conscience is that voice within us, having been trained by the moral law of God, that says to us, you're doing wrong. You're telling a lie. This isn't right, or whatever it happens to be. The voice of conscience, and when the conscience is telling us that we're doing something wrong, and we feel guilty about it, and we are doing something wrong, there's nothing wrong with that. Now, there is a whole movement of thought, and a lot of this came from Freud, Sigmund Freud, and psychology and whatnot, that has done a lot of damage, I would say, in this area. Freud was an atheist. And so, I mean, Freud's system was quite elaborate, but a part of it, the bottom line, turned out to be that rather than talking about true guilt, what he wanted to talk about was guilt feelings. That you may have guilt feelings because society, the church, your parents, that this is something, this moral code has been imposed upon you from the time you were young, and you've been told this is bad, and therefore when you do it, you experience guilt feelings. And rather than saying, let's remove the guilt feelings by stopping doing what you're doing, the focus was on how to get rid of the guilt feelings. So you just don't feel bad about it anymore. And I guess in theory, you can continue doing what you're doing, but you won't feel bad about it because you're trying to get rid of this superimposed morality that has come from the church, from your parents, from religion, from societal norms and whatnot. You're trying to get rid of that, these guilt feelings, and live your life in freedom. But this is not the direction that we want to go. As Catholics, as Christians, this is the way I think of it. God created me in his image and his likeness. He created me to be a finite mirror of who he is, of his being. And part of that is that he gave me rationality. He gave me a rational mind. He gave me a will, a free will. And he wrote his moral law on the tables of my soul. The moral law of God has been written on our hearts. It's engraved in us. And the way I look at it is that I want to know what is right and what is wrong, and I want to pursue holiness without which no one will see the Lord, Hebrews chapter 12, I think, verse 14. And therefore, I want to know when I've done wrong. I want to feel my conscience speaking to me. And if I'm guilty, I want to put it away. And the question was, how do you do that? Well, of course, confessing our sins to God, receiving forgiveness from God, because God loves us. Jesus died for us to create this infinite fountain of mercy that we can come to again and again and again to receive forgiveness for the things we do. And then as Catholics, of course, understanding that especially when we've committed serious sins, that we should go to confession. And I got to tell you, this is something I never did in my 20 years as an evangelical Protestant, but it is humbling to go to confession, as you probably well know. It is humbling to have to go into the confessional and to tell a living soul what you've done, especially if what you've done is something you do or something you do more than once and you're going back like, oh my, do I have to repeat this again? It is humbling. But of course, what we believe is that we bring these serious sins to God by confessing them to the priest. In the sacrament of confession, the priest will speak to us, give us some counsel. We will pray an act of contrition, and then the priest will pronounce words fly out of my mind, I'm too old. But anyway, we receive forgiveness for serious sins in that way through the confessional. But anyway, thanks for writing in the question, and let's go to the phone now. Beth, what did you have to say? You're on the line, Beth.
Hi.
I
was wondering, where did Goliath come from and the giants, so-called giants in the old Bible come from? A Protestant friend thinks that the fallen angels had children down here.
Yeah. I'm familiar with that. Okay. Let me try to organize my head because there's a lot that I potentially could say, and I always say too much and I want to whittle it down. Okay, Beth?
Okay.
Okay, there is a disagreement among biblical scholars and theologians about this issue. You're talking about Genesis chapter 6, where it says the sons of men saw the daughters of women. And what is that passage? You see, Genesis chapter 6, I want to quote it properly. Let me look it up quickly. Genesis chapter 6. Okay, I'm there. I'm basically there. Okay. When men began to multiply on the face of the ground, daughters were born to men. Okay, the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were fair, and they took to wife such of them as they chose. Then the Lord said, my spirit shall not always abide with man. And then that word Nephilim, the Nephilim were on the earth in those days and also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men and bore them children. These were mighty men that were of old, men of renown. Okay, Beth, there's a disagreement among biblical scholars and theologians as to what this is talking about. On the one hand, it's been the view that these sons of God are talking about fallen angels, and that we have a situation where fallen angels came down to earth and they had relations with women, and a race of hybrid creatures called Nephilim were born to them. And the word Nephilim just means fallen ones. That's what it means when you translate the Hebrew. On the other side of the coin, and I didn't learn this until I was in seminary, but I think this other side is correct. My Old Testament professor talking about this commented on the fact that when you read Genesis 1 through 6, okay, you have the story of Cain and Abel, and then you have Seth, their son, being born to them. And when you read Genesis chapter 4, you have the good line. You have the line of Seth being tracked out seven generations down to the generation of Noah. And this is the good line. This is the line of those who responded to God, who walked with God, and could be referred to as the sons of God. And then in Genesis chapter 5, we read about the bad line that came down from Cain and culminates in someone named Lamech, who has two wives, and maybe you remember this, and he brags about how, you know, he's going to reap vengeance sevenfold on anybody who hurts him and whatnot. And so the way that he explained it was, when you think about it, you have the good line tracked down in Genesis chapter 4, the godly line. And then in Genesis chapter 5, you have the ungodly line being tracked down. And what he believed, and what many scholars believe, is that when it talks about the sons of God seeing the daughters of men and having relations with them, it's talking about the intermingling of the godly line with the ungodly line and producing children that were fallen ones, Nephilim, fallen ones. And the reason this makes sense to me is within the context of Genesis 1 through 6, this makes sense. But also because if you read the Old Testament, there is this recurring theme as God is dealing with his earthly people, Israel, this recurring theme of God saying to them, I want you to be holy. I want you to be separate from the pagan nations around you. And I don't want you to intermarry with them. Because if you intermarry with the pagan nations around you, they will lead your hearts away from me and they will lead you astray. And there are several incidences in the Old Testament where that exactly happens, where we have stories of the Israelite men beginning to intermarry with pagan women and the catastrophe, spiritually speaking, that ensues after that. So I kind of think that that makes sense within the whole train of thought in the Old Testament, much more than some kind of a strange idea about alien, you know, fallen angels coming down. What do you think, Beth, about what I've said here? How does that strike you? Have you ever heard that before?
Yes, that makes more sense. I wasn't sure what they were called, but I know God made the Israelites strong and mighty at times. So in the Old Testament.
Yeah, and there were call them giants. There were large people at times. You know, you think about when the Israelites sent their spies into the land of Canaan to check it out, they come back and they say, we can't do it. We cannot go into the land of Canaan. We can't take it. I saw giants there. And then you mentioned Goliath, who was a large person. So there were people that were large. There may have been races of people that were larger than usual. And, you know, also describing them as giants may be a way of you know, exaggeration in a sense that the spies that went into the land, they came back. And I mean, you can imagine saying that. You see people that are really big and you see that they're strong and you see that they have mighty armies. And you're this ragtag group wandering through the wilderness, you know, on your way to Canaan. You might come back and say, we can't do it. We saw right. these people and they are big. They are big, you know.
Right.
And so I tend to think that that might be what's going on there too, more than there being a race of giants somewhere in the world.
Okay. That sounds great. Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Beth. Merry Christmas to you. And thanks for calling. Call back
Merry
anytime.
Merry Christmas. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you too. Bye.
Oh, it's time for a break. We'll be right back. Zach, Clay, stay on the line.
Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find out more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, I'm listening to that encouragement for your day. And I'm thinking, yeah, the encouragement I gave you today was get rid of your idols. Seek your happiness in God. I think that is encouraging, though. Okay, now, what is this music here? Is this, would you consider this to be, is this Beethoven? Is this something Beethoven wrote?
Very close, yeah. Well, just go with that.
Thank you, Cyrus. You're always giving me this crazy music. I don't know where it comes from.
Just keeping it on your toes, sir.
I want to take an email. This came from a listener in Bakersfield, California. Interesting question. What does the church teach on getting a prenuptial agreement? A young couple that already have family assets and business partners are planning to marry, and they asked if a prenup was allowed. Okay, now what I'm going to do here is I'm going to defer. I found where this exact question was asked to a priest, and he gave an answer, and I think the answer is probably really good. So I want to, I'll read the answer and maybe comment along the way, but I think that's a really good question and an interesting one. This was his answer. The church does not have a blanket prohibition against prenuptial agreements. I guess that's important to hear right away. The church does not have a blanket prohibition against prenuptial agreements, and no such, and so such an agreement does not in itself constitute an impediment to a Catholic marriage. In certain specific circumstances, a prenup can be warranted. Okay, so first point is simply to know the church has not taken a stand, making a blanket prohibition against having a prenuptial agreement. And so this does not constitute, at least in theory, this doesn't constitute an impediment to a Catholic marriage. And then he gives an illustration. Let's say, for example, that a widow marries a widower, and they both have children from their previous marriages. A prenup is a legitimate way of clarifying what is common property and what is separate as a basis for determining the inheritance rights of each spouse's children. Okay, so you have a complicated situation where a man who has children from a previous marriage marries a woman who has children from a previous marriage. She's a widow, he's a widower, and a prenup might be used to just clarify what is common property, what is not common property, what belongs to each of the children. And, man, I know of so many. I'm kind of going off the track here slightly, but I know of several examples of people in families where their father divorced their mother and then got married again, and the new wife just had no interest in the kids from the previous marriage, and they were just X'd out of the inheritance, and things like that. And so what he's saying is that an example like that would be one where it might be legitimate, just a way of clarifying what is common property. But then he goes on to say, in most cases, though, the very mention of a prenup should raise concerns in a priest's mind. Should raise concerns. Here's why. The clear teaching of the Catholic Church is that marriage is permanent and requires an unconditional commitment. In a wedding ceremony, the priest goes on to say, before they take the vows, I ask the couple, have you come here freely and without reservation to give yourselves to each other in marriage? So apart from the sort of situation that I've indicated above with the widow and the widower, it would make me nervous for a couple to raise the issue of a prenup, and I would always question them about their understanding of the indissolubility and their pledge of permanence. I certainly would not marry a couple if I thought they were simply trying to create an escape hatch. And I guess that's the primary problem that we would have as Catholics and that a Catholic priest would have, is that in this society now where so many marriages break up and where so many people enter marriage with the idea in their mind, okay, I'm giving this a shot, but if this doesn't go well, I'm going to get out of it. Then the trend toward having a prenup would simply be an expression of this fact that we're not really committed. I'm just not really committed. This may work, this may not work, and so I want to make sure I've got, you know, everything covered and that I'm protected, and that in a divorce settlement, you know, I'm not going to get, you know, my money dragged away from me, things like that. And I think he's right in saying that this would raise concerns in a priest's mind. That is, the mention of a prenup in a priest's mind, he's going to be concerned, first of all, right away, because the clear teaching of the church is that marriage is permanent and it requires unconditional commitment. You walk into marriage and you're supposed to be saying, I am here. You're not supposed to be saying, I'm here, but notice I've got one little foot out the door and I'm going to keep it that way in case things don't go well. And therefore, in most cases, or at least in many cases, when people start talking prenup, it's sort of a code for, I don't really understand the Catholic view of marriage and I'm not really committed to it. I'm not committed to the fact that I'm taking a vow and this is permanent and I want to keep my options alive. But, and I think it is important to say, then there are circumstances, though, like the one that he mentions, in which a prenup might be legitimate. And so I think that what this good priest is saying is that he would want to examine the couple. And if he is confident that they have the right view of what marriage is and the right view of their commitment that they're freely entering into and that they're going to give themselves without reservation, if he understands that and believes that, then there might be occasions when a prenup would be wise to separate out things so that maybe your kids, you know, from your previous marriages don't live their lives, you know, chewing on their, you know, fingernails, worried that they're going to be just cut out because someone decides who cares about them anymore and whatever. I mean, I have a situation that I'm very familiar with where the father there was a divorce in the family and the father had remarried. And the kids grew up knowing this stepmother, knowing her very well. But after the father died, she remarried and she married someone else who wasn't interested at all in those kids. And they just got X'd out of the world, really, out of the entire situation. And they have nothing, even though their father told them when he was still alive that I have saved an inheritance for you. Now there is no inheritance. So anyway, that's a good question. Okay, let's go to Clay in Huntsville, Alabama. Clay, you're on the line. Good morning.
Hey, can you hear me okay?
Just fine.
Hello. Yeah, I was calling. I'm currently going through the RCIA process, and my wife is not so much as excited. We've been going to a Protestant church, and it's got kind of all the lights and cool things. And anyways, my question is, mm-hmm. I understand there's a holy day of obligation for Catholics to attend Mass on Sunday or Saturday vigil. And that's one of the things I'm struggling with is I want to be fair to my wife and still give her the option to show her I'm still invested in, you know, leading our family spiritually. And so her request is that I go to church with her every other Sunday and then she go to Mass with me every other Sunday. And anyways, I'm just curious if there's any objection to that, you know, in yeah. regard to Catholic teaching.
Well, Clay, the question you're asking is one that I deal with an awful lot, because in my work, I'm the director of pastoral care for the Coming Home Network, and my primary work all day long, every day, is working with Protestant pastors that are on a journey toward the Catholic Church. And so this question comes up all the time, because many of them, I won't say many, but some of them have wives that over time begin to understand what they've learned and are with them. And at the time that they resign their ministry, they are together with their wife and they go to RCIA together and they become Catholic together. This is how it was for me and my wife, and I'll come back to that in a moment. But then there are situations that are more like yours, where one is becoming Catholic and the other is not there, is just not there. And you may not be happy to hear this, but what I encourage them to do is to serve their wives by doing both. That is, as a Catholic, you do have the Sunday obligation. It's the obligation of the church that you attend Mass on Sunday or on the vigil Mass on Saturday evening. And so what I would say to you is that no, this doesn't somehow get you out of the Sunday obligation, that you should try to find a way to unobtrusively be in Mass every week and then also join your wife. And this might be too much for you, but I have some men that have begun going, you know, they became Catholic, and so they've begun attending Mass every Sunday or Saturday evening for the vigil Mass. And then they attend with their wife every week simply because they want to say to their wives, I am not, by becoming Catholic, I'm not leaving you. And I want to encourage you in your walk with Christ and in your growth in the faith, and I will go with you every week. I'll be in church with you every week, but I'm also going to go to Mass and find a way to do that so that it's not obtrusive in a very blunt or exaggerated way. What do you think about that, Clay?
Yeah, I think that's satisfactory. I asked the question to my deacon and one of the other priests, and they kind of gave me some, they told me to not be so legalistic about it and just kind of like stop overthinking it and try to make it to Mass and, you know, do the best you can to get there. And, you know, if you're unable to make it and, mm-hmm. you know, something comes up where, you know, so they kind of told me almost like mm-hmm. relax, have a beer, stop sweating so much. Like that was kind of the approach.
Well, I don't know if I want to comment on what they said without being there and hearing them speak, but to say something like, hey, kick back, relax, have a beer, don't worry about it. Yeah. I mean, as though the Sunday obligation is just a suggestion, like, you know, this would be good, you know, you should try to do this, but if you can't, it's fine. No, it's an obligation, and it's one you should take very seriously, meaning that if you can't make it, or you're ill and you know, something like that comes up, but it shouldn't be, hey, kick back, take it easy. Don't be so hard on yourself, that kind of thing. Right. It shouldn't be like that. Yeah. You know, I want to say that
I tend to be more so of like, I want to make sure if I'm doing it, I do it right and not, uh-huh. you know, like not be a cafeteria, you know, pick and choose what I like and don't like. So.
Right, right. Well, listen, let me kind of like fill out my story slightly for you. I was a Baptist pastor, as I've mentioned. I was a pastor for 11 years. When I began to study the Catholic faith, and when I was on back in November, I told some of this story, so apologize if I'm repeating, but I never even thought about becoming Catholic, Clay. I mean, it was a thought that had never once crossed my dense head, okay, or my mind. And then I found out that Scott Hahn had become a Catholic, and it was out of the blue. Someone came to me on a Sunday night in my congregation, and he just basically said, look, I've been arguing with these Catholics down in San Diego at a place called Catholic Answers. And believe it or not, they had sent him a bunch of material. Actually, Patrick Madrid had sent him a bunch of material to read, because Patrick was an apologist at Catholic Answers at the time. I'm talking about 1992, I think, the fall of 1992. And he said, I've got this set of tapes by someone named Scott Hahn called Answering Common Objections Against the Catholic Faith. Well, Scott Hahn is someone that I had known in a previous life, meaning when I was in seminary, Fuller Theological Seminary, 10 years before this night. And I didn't know that Scott had gone on to become Catholic. We had become friends and we spent some time together and we talked about the Bible and biblical theology and all the things we were learning and excited about as Christians. And then we lost track of each other. So out of the blue, Clay, I suddenly hear that Scott has become Catholic, and I listened to his conversion story and I began to talk with him. And this is what began the whole thing in my life. But I got to tell you, when I started to read Catholic literature, my wife Tina thought I was insane. She couldn't even believe that I was doing what I was doing. And her attitude about it was very practical at that time. It was simply, you're a pastor. You are the pastor of a Baptist church. And I'm a pastor's wife. And we have a home and we have children. And we have a church that loves us and you love them. What are you doing? You follow what I'm saying, Clay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, it's more than just religious preference. It's that impacts your employment and everything else. Yeah.
Yeah, it was going to change. Well, that's the thing is she's more practical than I am too, and so she mm-hmm. ran the tape forward, and she just sort of recognized right away what the logical implications would be of this, and so her attitude, mm-hmm. you know, she knew if you become Catholic, we're going to lose everything we have. We're going to, you know, mm-hmm. she just knew that, but also she had no interest in becoming Catholic. She loved, you know, she loved Christ. She loved evangelical Christianity that we were used to. She loved mm-hmm. our life. And it was just like I was coming home and basically taking this massive wrench and just throwing it into the gears. And sure. she didn't understand. So it took a long time. But the point that I'm making and the reason I'm bringing this up to you is that it took a long time for her to begin to understand that this was serious in me. And therefore begin to listen to what I was saying, the things I was learning. And as I began to talk to her more and describe the things I was learning, and she began to understand them herself, then she began to soften toward the whole thing. But you know what? I would have had a hard time becoming Catholic if she had been opposing it totally. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying I never would have become Catholic, but I definitely would have prioritized that relationship and I would have waited. And I would have given it a mm-hmm. lot of time. I mean, besides the fact that I had to know that I was certain because I was going to leave the ministry, you know, and I was going to lose my yeah. income and I was going to wind up like Willie Loman in The Death of a Salesman, you know, walking up and down the sidewalk in a cheap suit looking for a job in yeah. midlife. But a big part of it was her. And that is, I wanted to know that she was on board. And in the end, she came on board. Oh, I'll tell you one more thing, Clay, because this might crack you up. About 3 years into my study of the Catholic faith, Tina says to me at one point, and she's more on board now. She's halfway there, let's say. She said, "What are you going to do?" And I said, I think that I have to resign. I think I have to resign the ministry to become Catholic. And she said, "But are you sure?" And I remember responding something like, "You mean like mathematically certain, you know, like 2 and 2 right. equals 4 and nothing but 4? And I said, "How can I say that? But I'm pretty sure." And she begged me. She said, "Please, will you give it one more year? We will talk. We will study. But will you study? Will you pray? Give it one more year. And then if you are sure, then we will resign and I will leave with you and we will work toward entering the Catholic Church." And I gave in, and I said, okay, I'll give it a year. And you know what she did? She walked out of the room, Clay, and she came back, and she dropped a stinking contract in front of me that she had sketched out.
Oh, wow.
and she said, "Sign it." And so I did. I signed it.
Yeah.
We took one more year, and then, God help us, we resigned the ministry. We walked out. She and I went to RCIA together, and we both entered the Catholic Church together. We have a break. Sorry I went over. A short break, and then we'll come back to finish up today. Thanks, Clay, for calling in. God bless you.
Our sponsor, the Catholic Order of Foresters, is here to help with this year's health insurance open enrollment. They offer individual, couple, and family options to best fit your needs. Before January 15th, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
Christmas is the time of year.
Welcome to the Patrick Madrid Show. We are nearly at the end of our time together, and then it will be Merry Christmas and to all a good night. This is this person singing, Cyrus, sounds like a country singer. Is that, am I right?
How dare you?
Don't whip me like you did last time.
This is Ray Charles, and this is in my top five favorite Christmas songs.
That's awesome. Love this song. That's beautiful. Ray Charles. Not a country singer.
And it's not polka.
Not German polka.
No.
Not acid rock. Nothing like that. Welcome to the Patrick Madrid Show. This is Ken Hensley filling in for Patrick Madrid. I've had a good time today so far. I hope you have as well. We've had some great conversations so far. What does the voice say? Tantalizing insights or important insights or something like that. I hope that's true. Listen, though, we're going to just cover a couple more things before we sign off for the day. Here's another email that came in. When I learned the Glory Be prayer, we did not cross ourselves when we said to the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. When did that start? Okay, let me give a simple answer to begin with. I have no idea. I just have no idea when it started in terms of time. But I want to say something about this practice of crossing, because, of course, I never crossed myself in 20 years as an evangelical. And even though crossing yourself, I mean, even though Paul says whatever you do, whether you eat or drink, whatever you do, do it all in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ. And even though it's a beautiful thought that everything we do, we would do in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. And it's so natural when praying that prayer, glory be to the Father and to the Son and the Holy Spirit, as it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. It's so natural to cross yourself. Protestants have developed a lot of traditions that are based really upon rejecting Catholicism. And that is, I don't care if it's beautiful, I don't care if it's good, if it's something the Catholics do, we are not going to do it. We're not going to do it. So the question comes, when did this begin? And I just want to say that the practice of Christians making the sign of the cross, it's very ancient. We have positive evidence in the early church fathers that such a practice was familiar to Christians, even in the second century. Now, of course, you don't have every subject discussed by the early church fathers, but early in the second century, we have Tertullian famously writing, and I think this is really a funny quotation, I really enjoy it. This is Tertullian writing in the second century, late second century. In all our travels and movements, in all our coming in and going out, in putting on our shoes, at the bath, at the table, in lighting our candles, in lying down and sitting down, whatever employment occupies us, we mark our foreheads with the sign of the cross. And it's kind of funny, it's humorous, but I really love it. He's basically saying, we Christians are known for this. You know, we're walking down the street, we're signing ourselves with the cross. We're going to buy something, we're crossing. We're getting ready to eat, we're crossing. Whether we're walking, whether we're lying down, whether we're sitting down, getting into the bathtub, getting out at the table. It's just natural for us to cross ourselves and to offer up a silent prayer. Lord, what I do now, I do in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Now, very early, it also became a sign of blessing or benediction. It was a way of blessing someone to make the sign of the cross. And I know many parents, and I think it's a beautiful thing, you know, will make the sign of the cross on their children's foreheads as they're putting them to bed. Well, here's St. Cyril of Jerusalem writing in the 4th century. This is what he said, quote, "Let us then not be ashamed to confess the crucified. Be the cross our seal, made with boldness by our fingers on our brow, and in everything, over the bread we eat and the cups we drink, in our comings and in our goings," sounds like he had read Tertullian on this, "before our sleep, when we lie down, when we awake, when we are traveling, and when we are at rest." Let the sign of the cross, let our lives be marked in every way by the sign of the cross. And I'm going to take one more call quickly that came up before we end our show today. Jordan calling from St. Paul, Minneapolis, or Minnesota. Good morning, Jordan.
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, very well.
Okay, great. Yeah, I heard Clay's comments about balancing how to best work with his wife becoming Catholic, and I actually share the same story. I recently became Catholic this year and came to the church on the Feast of the Cross, and at first my wife was like freaking out. Now you want to go to Mass, and you know how we're kind of in between switching churches. And one of the tips I have for him, just really quick, is that which worked really well with us is I actually have three young boys, and I find what really works well is say, hey, honey, I'm going to take the kids to a Saturday evening vigil Mass or a Sunday night Mass, and you can have time just to relax and, you know, just to be able to do whatever you need to do, and then go to church with her on Sunday mornings. To, you know, the Protestant church we go to. And it in a lot of ways, it makes her feel really, really blessed because, you know, you're giving her space away from the kids. And plus you're able to invest in your children, you know, in terms of kind of instructing them a little bit more in the Catholic way as well.
That's a great idea, Jordan. And the thing that I really like about it is that you are serving, that you're putting yourself in the place of a servant. The worst thing that someone could do is become Catholic and then just have this sort of, well, I'm going to Mass, tough luck with you sort of thing come through, you know, or, you know, I'm not going to go to your, you know, flimsy church. I'm going to Mass. Here's a situation where you are putting yourself out and you're giving your time, you're giving your energy and time to instruct your children and to give your wife a break. In other words, you are the one bending over backwards to serve and to be a servant in this situation. And the reason I think this is so good too, and this may speak to others, but often Protestants, depending on what kind of Protestantism they've been raised with, you know, depending on how fundamentalist it is, how anti-Catholic it is, this is something I say to my Protestant ministers all the time too, that, you know, your wife may believe that becoming Catholic is like joining a cult. She's been taught to think that when you become Catholic, that you're joining this deformed, degraded, false version of Christianity that that arose in the 4th century, you know, under Constantine, the Emperor of Rome, and all that. And one of the main things you have to do, not only with your wife, but let's say with your parents who may feel that way, or brothers and sisters, is that you have to show them that you're not leaving Christianity, that you haven't left Christ, that you feel like what you've entered into is the fullest expression of Christianity. And so one way to do that is to make sure that the people you are, quote unquote, leaving behind, hopefully only for a time, a short time, is showing them that becoming a Catholic is making you a better Christian, not a worse one. And I think that what you're doing, Jordan, is a great example of that. How's it working out, by the way?
It's been wonderful. I mean, at first it was really hard, right? It was like pulling off the Band-Aid. But as you know, even one some daily Mass mornings, if I have time and she's just frantic with kids, I'll say, hey, let me take at least the two little ones out. And you can just take one kid and, you know, get them out of the house. Then, you know, I get spiritually fed, get Eucharist, and then she gets time to relax. And then I just find it works really well to free her up. And, you know, I started serving on a pregnancy resource center that our Catholic church is involved with. And I started plugging this resource center into the Protestant church we've been going to.
Right.
And I just find that finding ways that, you know, because a lot of Christians believe in the sanctity of life. It's like, how do we find ways to work together, right? And, you know, help share that love to draw people closer to Christ, right? Which I think the fullness of the faith is the Catholic faith. But it's, you know, I think it takes time for people's eyes to be revealed to that.
Well, you know what? I think you're saying this, you're stating this so well that I don't really even want to comment. I'll give you the last word. In fact, the last word of the entire show, if you want to conclude with do you have another comment to make? But I think what you're doing is great, and it's a great idea.
Yeah, I think for anybody who's, you know, on the borderline thinking about becoming Catholic, and you're afraid of what family might think, just do it. Just don't worry, because, you know, there's going to be spiritual warfare that might come against you. But ultimately, like, the enemy, you know, I guess, right, Mary crushes the serpent's head, right? Like, he's defeated. So, you know, it might take time, but ultimately, like, God's going to win in the story. And the Catholic Church is going to, you know, is the place to go. So,
thanks so much for calling in, Jordan. And I hope you can call in again. And I think the message of that is right on. As long as you make it your intention to show everyone that becoming Catholic has made you love the Lord more and is making you a better Christian, then that will go a long way. God bless you. It's been great to be with you today. Merry Christmas to you all. And this is Ken Hensley signing off for Patrick Madrid.